Welcome to Watching Silent Films. This is Yifeng, and with me are my co-hosts Lily and Adam.
Hello there.
Hello.
Greetings.
Greetings, greetings. This is the penultimate episode, and if you don't know what that word means, it means the one next to the last. I made that announcement last episode, but we'll get into that more in the final episode. But for now, this will be the final episode from Adam. Thank you very much. He is a longtime listener. And we exchanged emails one day, and now he's a co-host. So, because it's really everybody can come and become a co-host. So, thank you very much, Adam, for taking time out of your busy schedule.
My pleasure.
Very much appreciate it. So now you're on both sides. So you're both the fan, but also creating the content they're going to listen to. I don't think
Sounds
your episodes
great.
Are out actually at the time of this
no,
recording,
it hasn't.
But it
Not
will
yet.
Be in the. You know, whenever Lily posts this stuff up, so.
Soon.
Oh, so, that's all right. So, all right. So today we're going to talk about Harold Lloyd's 1923 Safety Last, which is one of the best movies really ever made. Before I get there, just a little bit about what we've been watching. If you guys had a chance to watch anything in the classic realm, Lily or...
Yeah, I'm still making my way through Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Marilyn Monroe. I still have not finished it yet, but I'm working through it. It does not help when, you know, because we have our podcast, you know, I have to watch this, I have to watch our silent film, and that's completely fine. But any other film, I'm like, oh, you know, whatever. I did watch a film last week called Greta that was on Amazon Prime because I have it for a month, so it was very interesting. It's more modern. It came out last year, but it was written and directed and starred this one girl who lives in New York City. It's kind of about depression, but it's also not, and also finding your happiness in life. I believe the film's under 20 minutes long, so it's not the Greta film with Chloe Grace Moretz. It's more of an indie feature. So if you want to see something different, I'd watch it again and take a look. Amazon Prime. Boom.
Sounds interesting. Is it over to me?
Yep. Over to you, Adam.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, you mentioned Greed. So I just had the urge to watch it. I did find the 4-hour version of it on Vimeo.
Nice.
Yeah. I read the background a little bit about how they colored everything in that gold, and that must have been just so painstaking to do that. It was synced to the music of Johnny Greenwood, which I'm not familiar with, but it was after listening to it for so long, I had to switch it to Pandora just to come out of the depression it was putting me in. The description of the story is John Mateague. It's taken from a book called Mateague. He's a miner working in California. A traveling dentist called himself Dr. Painless Potter visits the town, and Mateague's mother begs Potter to take her son as an apprentice. Potter agrees. Mateague eventually becomes a dentist practicing on Polk Street in San Francisco. If I read it right, this might have been one of the first ones to shoot on location for the whole thing. I didn't realize that was the case because I thought I've seen other films before that shooting on location, but I'm not really sure how they categorize things. Basically, the drama starts when his best friend, Marcus, brings in his cousin, Trina, to have her teeth worked on, and Mateague fell in love with her. As he was examining her, and it was getting to the point where, as she was under with the ether, he was basically inhaling her hair. And it was just, you know, it was a little bizarre for that alone. And Trina, after she came to, there's this woman that would come through the offices or the boarding house. I think he might have worked out of his boarding house, selling lottery tickets. She buys one, I think. I'm not sure if it was for a dollar or not, but anyway, she wins $5,000. And before this even happened, Mateague and Marcus agreed that Trina could be Matigue's. Marcus actually wanted to marry her too, which I don't know how that works with first cousins, but apparently that seemed to be something that was in the works. But they were such a good friend, and he saw how much Matigue was in love with her that he says, okay, that's fine. But when she won the $5,000, he, you know, he took it about face mentally. And just things just there was a rift that happened basically all over money. I mean, the title Greed played such a big part of basically the whole movie. After they got married, Trina refused to spend any of her $5,000, and she would earn money on the side, and she was completely obsessed with that $5,000. I think the only thing she might have used some of it for was her uncle's business, and he would have to pay interest back. The novel was written in 1899, and it was based on a real crime in 1850. Could have been the same spot, I'm not sure, on that location. It was Eric Stronheim. There was 85 hours of footage before editing. It was supposed to go for about 9 hours, and the studio made him cut it down, but there's been writings that 9 hours was mostly, you know, unrefined. So I don't know if that would have been the true length of the film that Stronheim wanted, but he got it down to 4, and then they got it down from that to, I think, maybe 2 hours. I'm not sure what. And they basically cut the two of the subplots. He did a lot. Stronheim did a lot with using metaphors, like a cat was used as a stand-in for Marcus, and the lovebirds in the cage that Matigue was really into would stand for the couple. And so the cat was eyeing the cage all the time, trying to devour the birds. And Marcus was basically wanting in on that money. The film was hand-tinted in gold in many spots, the coins, the candle flames, the canary, done by a process called Handschiegel. I really didn't understand how that works out, but there was a name to it. Wedding scene when they got married, Stronheim just showed more metaphors of the lower class. They weren't on par with the quote-unquote higher class, and they would show a couple of the people feeding off the skulls of some animal. I've never seen like that ever before. You know, it was I don't even know what the animal was, but there was two of them just gnawing away, and the meat was already gone off the skull. So you were looking at the skull. Normally in films, meals would be shown with dignity and a sense of community, but images of a small person, a hunchback, a woman with buck teeth, a boy on crutches, with other guests crudely devouring their meals like animals. He would show their lower class environment as like when they were courting each other, they would sit on a sewer and there'd be a dead rat right next by. And when they were kissing, a garbage truck would drive by. So these were all images that he was playing with and getting you into the story itself. The junk man, which was one of the subplots that were put in, what happened was the film was gone, but they found a lot of photographs was basically scene by scene by scene. So they just filled it in and told you what the story would have been. And the junk man was played by Cesar Gravina, and he was in The Man Who Laughs, which is one of the movies I really liked. He was the one taking care of Gwenplaine and Dia. And that's a bit about that. It was, you know, it was a long viewing, and like I said, the music kind of depressed me, but it was definitely, you know, something to see. And the last scene in the desert was the story behind it, I think, might have been more interesting than the actual watching it, because they were truly in 120-degree heat, and the camera itself had to be wrapped in ice cubes and towels just not to melt. And that's it.
Wow. What a story.
So, you know, hopefully, you know, in time you might find a better music accompaniment, because, you know, music makes these movies. But having said all of that, the whatchamacallit, did you think it was worthy of all those praises last night? As you know, it's
definitely, well, the more I read into it, and then it's one of those things that you might not realize what you're looking at until you read what other people had to say about it. Like, he,
because the Turner Classic has a by the way, musical score.
Oh,
composed by, because the version that you saw, right, that the 4-hour version has the Robert Israel score. It just, the reason why you didn't find it there is because that's copyright and therefore they can't post it on Vimeo. That's why.
Yeah, he threw his own and he said that in his notes.
Right.
But it was depressing. It was really depressing. And 4 hours of that.
So is it worthy of that, all these praises that you think that people have lavished upon it over the years?
Well, putting it in the context of the time, definitely. They said something about him using long focus, which, you know, I don't think I noticed at the time, but I can see it, how it was played. The 4-hour version gave it room to breathe, and you saw the story, because before I saw, I think, the 2-hour version, and the subtitles were in Italian, so I had to translate it myself. It was on DVD, so I couldn't even switch anything. So this time I actually saw the story. It was definitely interesting. It was a lot to it.
Yeah. Yeah, there are over time, all the greats, as it were, meaning like even contemporaries of silent film makers, they would lavish praises upon it. The ones that they have seen, like Sergei Eisenstein, the Russian director, really liked it. Ernst Lubitsch, as we know, loved it. Jean Renoir, son of that painter, loved it. Even Guillermo del Toro says he's called it, quote, a perfect reflection of the anxiety permeating the passage into the 20th century and absolute dehumanization that was to come. Mm. And on and on. I mean, it's just, you know, the anywhere from the Hitchcocks to, you know, the who's, you know, they all just have high praises on it. I can't remember, because there has never been really a good home video copy of it. Mm-hmm. So if I ever watch it, I must have seen the 2-hour. I haven't had a chance to watch the 4-hour one yet.
Well, that was just filled in with photographs. And then this.
Yeah, I know. That's the reconstruction. Are. Yeah. Right, but that's, you know, sometimes that helps you understand the story better. You know what I mean?
And so, it included the two subplots. The only people to really have a happy existence in that film was the elderly couple in the boarding house.
But, you know, like even the 4-hour is still not the 6.5 or 6 or something ridiculous like that cut. So, and I think, Von Stronheim, I don't know how much you researched into him, it was very much full of himself, I think, just time. I think that's part of his, well, at least that's what historians say, is that it is the failure, is that because he was so abrasive that people just often got rid of his movies.
Well, when he was in the desert, he wanted the two to look like they really hated each other. He says, I want you two to hate each other like you hate me.
Right.
So that says something. Plus, I read that book that you recommended a while ago.
Yeah.
And he was mentioned in there. And that always stuck in my head because it was the 60s by then. And he recreated what he did for Greta Garbo.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if it's still relevant today, but in a lot of filmmaking history, there's a stereotype of what a director looks like with the monocle and the cigar. Well, it all came from this guy. He's kind of the Erich von Stroheim was the predecessor or prototypical sort of European director who was the know-it-all and came in very much dictator-like fashion. But
he Sunset Boulevard? Was that him?
How's that?
Was he the one in Sunset Boulevard?
I don't know if he was in it, but I can't remember. But he was definitely, you know, he would have been. That was
the
him.
Butler
that's right.
was a famous
yeah,
director.
Yeah, that was him. Yeah,
that was. Yeah, that's what I said.
So it was directed by Billy Wilder, who obviously was, you know, doing a take on the transitioning of the film histories and that. But he appeared in it. Yeah.
That was a fun movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Highly recommend it, this cut, or?
Just with different music, but otherwise, I got everything I wanted out of it, and I was satisfied. Yeah, I've been wanting to watch it for a long time because it was in that book I mentioned, 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die, and so it was just like it was always in my head.
You saw the 2-hour cut, right?
With Italian subtitles, so it was just horrible.
So you weren't counting that viewing?
No, I really am not. This one, as far as I'm concerned, was seeing it for the first time.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else?
Well, I did watch a German one. I've become a Fritz Lang fan big time. This is 1924. The Nibelungen.
Oh, yes.
Heard of that? Yeah.
Fantasy, yeah.
That's on Canopy. There's two parts to it. The first one was the one watching. The second
part one, part two.
Took forever. It was just really drawn out. But the first one was really good. It was basically the Lord of the Rings of the day.
It's obviously based on the Germanic mythologies, right?
So from 1200, it was
which is where you know, of course, Lord of the Rings got a lot of their stuff from
the George R.R. Martin might have watched this too. I'm not sure if I read that right, and so if he did, I would think Game of Thrones had something to owe toward it. But there was just more. It was more visual than I thought it would be.
Yeah,
I mean, it starts off. I don't know what those people were that was around him teaching him how to be a blacksmith, but they look like maybe trolls or something.
Right.
The dragon that he had to kill. That was amazing. That was a huge prop that many people had to get in there to work around. The whole thing was great. The sets, it was just really good. Those are the two things.
Yeah, if you keep going, I really loved all of his songs are great, obviously, including, you know, the Metropolises. And Destroy and that one that you just mentioned. I mean, any and all of his works is great, especially
Destiny.
Songs,
but... Destiny.
Yeah, any of those. And once he transitions into talkies, really, he really is the connection piece. In my opinion, and he's one of many, but I feel like if you had to encapsulate this movement, and trace how film noir that we know later on, in terms of like the, bogey film noir, what's McCagney and any of those, you can actually trace it through this guy, Fritz Lang, that he would take sort of a lot of the German expressionism concepts and ideas. And through just immigrating and taking that idea from Europe and directly dumping it into Hollywood. And by the time he made talkies, when you get there, I don't know if you're going to continue, but if you do.
Oh, I've already watched a couple from the 40s.
Like
John Bennett. I think Clash it's
Scarlet Street. Blue Gardenia.
Well, John Bennett was in both of them, whatever the second one was.
You Only Live Once, any of those.
Yeah.
All of those are just incredible movies, technically, but the story is just so like, it's really rich and it's just full of like, you know, like noir. It has got everything, right? The femme fatale.
Well, suit.
Everything you can think of that.
Dreher or something. He was.
Yeah,
he
everything
was
you can think of that is like the stereotype of what film noir is.
Yeah.
There are elements that came from like, you know, all of his films. So yeah, I think, you know, he's either the godfather or the grandfather of noir that we know of today. And you can trace a direct path from the expressionism, the dark expressionism.
Scarlet Street was done as a French film, like, 10 to 14 years earlier. I think that one might have been called The Bitch if translated into English.
Right.
And
of course, you know, M. You've seen M, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing, especially that last...
The speech.
I don't know what to call that. Speech, okay, yeah.
Everybody wants to talk about speech, yeah.
I mean, you can hear a pin drop when he's just screaming, and it's like I don't think I've heard anything on film in that area before or after. You know, before 1950 anyway.
Yeah, anyway, so the point is, he ultimately brought so much, I think, from the oldest to the newest, you know.
Yeah, I think I'm on Team Lang.
Yeah, his final efforts were, there's a movie that took place in India. I can't remember whether it was The Tiger of something and The Indian Tomb. And then the final one's The Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse, which is the final wrap-up.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
Of the, it's kind of like the Fritz Lang universe, where this recurring character, Dr. Mabuse, and his detective, what's his name? There's a detective character in here.
Yeah, I'm not good with names.
Inspector Lohmann, that's what it is. So Inspector Lohmann actually appears in other movies, such as M. So somehow this...
Yeah, I think we talked about it last week.
Yeah, he seeds the Inspector Lohmann across other movies, too.
The Indian Tomb was the one before, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
So he's definitely one of the greats of film history.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything else?
No, I think I've talked enough.
Oh, no. We want to hear everything you have to say.
Yeah, I know. I just get self-conscious after a while of talking too long. I'm like, oh, my God, am I boring everyone? What's going on?
What would you recommend Nilly to start off with?
As far as Lang or anything in
Lang,
general?
Yeah, first Lang.
I'm in love with the first one I just saw, the Nibelungen. I think that means a tribe of people or something, because I tried to look up to see what that meant, and I think it's just the name of their group of people. But I don't know Lily's taste, but it just, you know, if you like Lord of the Rings, that's kind of it for 1924.
Mm.
It's like watching Irwin Allen a little bit.
Well, is it on the level of, like, I like fantasy stories, and I do like Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
I'm not a gigantic fan of it, but I, you know, I respect what they did because it's such, the trilogy is incredible.
Yeah.
Between, you know, what they did in the early 2000s. But is it on the level
of,
like, that's good.
Just to let you know which one to, I think it's more interesting than Hexen, to tell you the truth.
That's good.
The Nibelungen, just to give you, there's two of them. Go for the one that says Siegfried. Basically, the second one, I don't think it's spoiling anything to say that he gets killed at the end of it. And his second movie was just the wife, just doing anything she can to get the guy who killed him killed. And it took all of the movie to do it. And it just wasn't worth it. So just the first one, you can stop.
Interesting. Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, the whole thing was just very, very – I mean, it was visual. It was so visual. It didn't let you stop, and you had so much to look at. And obviously, it's 1924, so don't be too critical. The dragon doesn't look that real.
But, you know, we're a silent film podcast. We've been there.
What it is I've been reading this book, Nosferatu, and that's what's been pointing me toward – The Student in Prague, this one. As I go along, it's just like The Parade Gone By. It keeps recommending films, only it's all German. So, yeah, I've been having a great time with that book.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing was based on the Ring Cycle, right? That whole Nibelung mythology. It's actually – so that the films somehow were, I think, initially got inspired by – Richard Wagner, music composer, there's a Germanic language epic. It's called The Ring, and it's like a four-part cycle.
That I didn't know.
Loosely based on characters in the Norse saga, which is why it's got a familiar ring to Lord of the Rings, which is where it's heavily inspired a lot of the things that Lord of the Rings is about, because they're very much, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien was a big student of old heroic mythic legends of the
there was a movie on him on probably HBO about a year or two ago, so I got a piece of that. He had to have seen this film.
He's never into movies. I don't know about that, but I know that he's really into the primary sources. So he's not just about the movies. He would have probably read the original Germanic or Nordic language works, right? Or maybe perhaps even the opera, but he probably was never really into the movies. Maybe. Oh. So, anyways.
Well, I think it was fun. And it's free. It's Canopy.
Right. So the sort of the rough story or plot of the Ring Cycle is about a magic ring that grants the power to rule the world.
Yeah, that's
by Nibelung dwarves.
Yeah, no, that's not in the story at all.
All right, but the point is, that's the backdrop,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's a lot of gods and goddesses and, you know, all sorts of...
Well, it was mostly about him being in love with some king's sister and what he had to do to basically win her over. And then that king wanted someone else, so he had something that made him invisible to help that king win that person over, and then it just all hell broke loose.
But anyways,
yeah.
That, you know, all of these elements, you know, they all kind of take from one another. You know, the Germanic root ones takes from the Nordic, and I'm sure Nordic probably stole some stuff from the their brothers from the south, and on it goes. You know, they're very much influenced by one another, you know, over the years. So.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it.
And
it was very well restored.
It was good. Okay, so there you go, Lee, if you ever get into that.
There was like 11 or 12 sources that they got the film from, too.
Yeah. Well, they had to have some of these older ones.
Yeah, I just think that's amazing where they get a piece here, a piece there, all around the world, and finally it comes together.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The Murnau Foundation is part of the people who put it together, so that was interesting just in itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's their job, is to reconstitute some of these things that have over the years been lost. So, All right, let's move on into a look at a take on Safety Last, a 1923 American silent film comedy starring Harold Lloyd and... some background about this very much successful in its time as contemporary. It really cemented Harold Lloyd's status as a major figure. You know, you often do hear the name Chaplin, Keaton, but probably nowadays you'll probably hear more about Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd, but probably in the 80s and 90s, that was less so. And I think part of the reason is because what's great about Harold Lloyd, the man himself, is that he actually had the rights to his own movies. Yeah. So I would say Chaplin might be the closest to Lloyd in the sense that, you know, Chaplin also owns rights to his own stuff, but the difference between Lloyd and Chaplin is that Chaplin would sort of bring his work out over and over again through revivals and stuff like that. And, of course, he was incredibly popular and everybody wanted to watch his works over and over and over again. And he was very much agreeable to all of that, right? And so that, I think, lends itself to Chaplin's staying power. In terms of popularity, definitely in terms of popularity, probably greater for sure, just both in that time as well as that time since, you know, the silent era. Now, Buster Keaton, of course, doesn't own the rights to his films, sadly, because he probably used to own the rights to his shorts and also up to when he started working for MGM. Mm-hmm. But all of his output after that, he became a hired hand, basically. So he didn't have rights to stuff like The Cameraman afterwards. But I don't know what he did. I never looked it up. But, you know, for whatever reason, his work was still in demand and very popular in revivals, just like Chaplin. And that's why it leads to why both of those names very much are out there, along with many other silent film greats. But I think part of the problem is this. After sort of owning the rights to his films, he really wanted to show these films the way that he means it to be, right? Because he's the original filmmaker. And so he's like, you know, people were interested, I think, in trying to get his movies re-released in movie theaters. But most theaters at that time, because now they're talkies, they don't accommodate pianos or organs or anything like that. And so, like, you know, he basically has a mandate saying it's got to be organs or like orchestra or something better, but actually not pianos. He says, and I quote, "I just don't like pictures played with pianos. We never intended them to be played with pianos." And so from there on, if you don't have an organ, which is expensive, right? They probably took a lot of them out after the topics came out.
Yeah.
And anyway, long story short, I think it's because of his creative control and how he wants his films to be re-released that it never got popular. Also, when television came around, his prices were also really high. He wanted $300K per picture for showings. And at that point, I don't know what it was, but it's you know, he wants it to be done the way he wanted it to be done, you know? And that's why I think his reputation suffered over the years, you know, from the 40s, 50s, and beyond. And but, you know, after his death, you know, another corporation, Time Life, you know, started to release that with stuff that he doesn't like, you know, with different frame rates, weird music on it. They don't care. They're out to make money. So the quality of presentation, the thing that he really wanted, basically only lasted during his lifetime. Afterwards, when he's gone, I don't think his kids were given the, like, to carry on the legacy. You know what I mean? So, anyways, that's just some background about Harold Lloyd, and really more about the aftermath, actually. I was going to talk about how it came to be. But anyway, so that's him in a nutshell, in terms of how he – that's why he's not as popular, I guess. It's more my thought process going around that.
Well, it makes sense, too, when you bring up just the, you know, bringing these reels to the theater. I mean, it comes down to money, unfortunately, even back then. It's like, well, are they going to hire an accompanist, or are they going to hire someone else to, you know, just keep doing what they're doing, and, you know, as progression keeps happening with the talkies? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't just copy it with the soundtrack on it. Just like they do now.
I think Lloyd, like many of the silent filmmakers, really wants this to be performed as it was back in the day. And that's why he had a stringent requirement for that to be in revivals and stuff. Because remember, like, back in those days, prior to talkies and technology, there wasn't any speakers or anything. You needed somebody to be there and provide the accompaniment. And the accompaniment, that's why, like, that's the big thing about, and we keep, it's like a being a dead horse, but, like, we do, like, the silent films were meant to be enjoyed like a concert, like a music concert. And when you watch it in the big theater and you have a live music, whatever form it takes place in, that music washes over you, and you really are in there for an experience, like you do a music concert, like whatever your favorite bands are. And if they're great live and you watch their concert, you'll remember that concert for the rest of your life. And that concert will never happen again, right? Because it's a unique experience where you attended a concert and you remember, whether it's the people that you went with or just the experiences of that concert with the artist, you have this direct connection. And I think the silent film era films were like that. Like, they, whatever music was played in that specific time that you were watching, that showing, that's the feeling I think it's trying to invoke, is that you remember that, you know?
Right.
And so, like, there aren't a lot of chances of, obviously, nowadays to do that. But I still remember that I watched Metropolis, going back to Fritz Lang, when they did the complete cut. They found the footage in Brazil. And I watched it with the Alo Orchestra, which is local, by the way, and in Coolidge Corner. I remember that because, you know, like it literally was a concert, right, of the live accompaniment playing even though you're watching the film on screen. It is like, and the audiences were going along for the ride in all the right places, and you get all the right responses. I mean, that's just something that you can't remove from, especially silent films. That's unique, you know. It's part of like film enjoyment, and you can certainly do some of that, and I certainly, there are still some of that, like especially when Star Wars came out in 77. I'm sure a lot of people remember where they were when they first sat down somewhere, or was with friends in the theater, and on and on. So that still existed even post, you know, the talkies. But I think silent film era, or films from silent era, is a lot more unique because you have this music, live music performing element that doesn't exist in the talkies and after, you know?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Yeah. Well, now you've mentioned many times the Avengers, the Marvel, and those are event films for the most part.
Right.
I know that was something, just before he passed, we took my father and the rest of us went out to see it, and he was very happy to see that. That was an exciting time for him, so I'm glad we did that. They still have movies that create those memories.
Right. And, you know, a lot of the times, especially something like that, where it's going on to the theater. Of course, right now it's a pandemic. The theaters don't exist anymore. But like, when it was available that you could safely go to one, I think part of it is having those memories, right? With friends and family, and you kind of partake. And that's why you'll often hear a lot of the artists who are creating these movies liken that to religious experiences. Like, I was listening to podcasts from the DGA, with the Directors Guild America, and there's a, I think it's James Gray or something. He is a director for Ad Astrata with Brad Pitt. And he says, like, he's an atheist, but he believes that the films, film watching, and the whole experience is very much a religious experience, like straight up.
Right.
And even though
that
he doesn't
movie
like,
was rough.
Right, sorry, the, go but ahead. You get my point is that he, you know, really wants to have the ability for people to go to the theater and have this experience with one another as you do almost like going to church, you know. So anyways, that's totally aside, but kind of related that the silent filmmakers like Harold Lloyd really treasured that. And even though talkies have pre-recorded sound and it's possible, he just was unrelenting, I think, in terms of not wanting people not to experience that. And really wanted people to have that experiences as they're watching his specific silent films. They were made with specific things in mind. In his case, he wants people to watch it with the organ and or for orchestras, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, it's his.
Yeah.
And he definitely had the fan base to support it, so.
Right.
He was into 3D films for a while. He was really into 3D films. I don't know a lot about it, but I've been hearing that over and over whenever I hear interviews with somebody. Like his...
Who, Harold Lloyd?
Harold Lloyd, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you look into it, I think he might have even done it in the 20s, but I've never seen any of those. I've seen his 50s stuff.
Well, I mean, he's always been into experimenting technology, so that's not news. And I think all of them were. The Chaplins, the Keatons, all of them have had a hand in experimenting with whether it's the 3D or the widescreen format or even color. All of them have had experiments with this because, you know, whether it's the codec, the makers of the film itself, whether it's the camera makers or manufacturers or the vendors, they're all going to try to sell some of these technologies, right, to all these famous filmmakers. And it's the same thing as today, you know, they whatever new technology they have, they want to sell it. And so, like, you know, that's why, like, James Cameron is still making his avatars in 3D because he likes the technology. He wants to use it that way for his movies, you know. And so, you know, so same as it was back then and same as it was today, you know.
Right.
Anyway. So back to this particular film, Safety Last, I think this is now If you were to look at his filmography, Harold Lloyd started in the early 19-teens, 1913, and he would make a series of things, you know, and of course, you know, most of the silent films are lost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what's great is that he's kept a lot of them, which is great. But unfortunately, the early film shorts that he kept were lost to fire in his own estate. Like,
oh,
he physically kept it, and, you know, so he lost a lot of it in 1943.
Yeah.
So, but he still carefully preserved a lot of them. And anyway, so that's the, you know, of all the artists out there, he's still pretty, he was able to keep as much of it as possible, the ones that were lost in the fires. But anyway, so like the all the other silent film comedians we talked about, like the Chaplins, like the Keatons, you know, all of them started with the one reelers, two reelers, right? Mm-hmm. All the shorts, and until the 1920s, right? In the 1920s is when all of those artists started to make feature films, which is,
yeah,
it's weird, but not weird, because that's kind of how the industry worked. So at this point, he would have made, he would have been about seven, do the math right, 7-4. So probably about, yeah, a decade in the industry or so, you know, starting with the silent shorts. And now he's made probably two or three films. He did Sailor, Maid Man, Grandma's Boy, Dr. Jack, and now he's this is
bumping on Broadway. I have it as the third, but that's what the commentary I listened to said anyway.
Yeah,
so whether they were.
Well, it might have to do with just how
right
the order of when it was shot and it was released, and because they made all these in breakneck speed, right? So.
Uh-huh.
Anyways. So, this is the feature that was made and directed by, Hal Roach, is very, very famous, not directed, I'm sorry, produced by Hal Roach. Well, Hal Roach is very popular because he's remembered for stuff like Laurel and Hardy franchise and Charlie Chase and Our Gang, but he also was very much a staple of the silent film era. Launching careers of many, many, many actors, actresses, and other people. Anyways, so, and his stars, a lot of his pictures stars, I don't think they were married yet, but they would have been eventually.
Right afterwards.
His wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. So that's kind of the safety last. I think he's, it's a little bit like a, at that point they're not quite, or maybe they were, I'm not sure what, how do you draw the lines, but they're kind of like getting into kind of a studio system, at least the very much the early days or versions or iterations of their studio system, which was like a dream factory, they call it. You'll pump out film after film after film, right? And this is very much no different. That at this point, they're well-oiled machine, and with a lot of experiences, just like all of his contemporaries. You know, you work on this story, and just anyways, what do you guys think overall of this safety last?
Well, I watch this on Criterion, like everything else, whenever I can. Let's see, this one had the commentary with Leonard Maltin and Harold Lloyd's longtime archivist. Richard Carell, which I've never heard of the second person. So I kind of took notes as they were rattling off. Otherwise I wouldn't know as much. Let's see. He's obviously very athletic, and it was amazing since he lost his index finger and thumb on his right hand because of ad he was doing, and he was holding a bomb that was supposed to be a fake bomb, and somehow it really went off. And so that really put him down for a while. So the fact when you're looking at his hand now, it's a prosthetic glove. So the fact that he can climb the building like that, is just amazing. The commentators mentioned that Mildred Davis, who played the girl, those two married each other right after this film. I think it was the last film she did with him, but she did three more somewhere else on her own after that. But they stayed married, as far as I know, to their deaths. She was his second leading lady. I always liked the gag where they were in the rooming house and the landlady was coming for her rent. So they jumped into the long coats to hide. And I just recently saw, I think it might have been his first full-length feature called Bumping into Broadway. And this was before he lost his part of his hand. And he did the same thing there. So he uses some of the gags more than once. I didn't know that until I saw that. The roommate and friend was Bill Strother. He was a human fly in real life. He injured himself before the movie was shot, so he was in a lot of pain throughout this movie. And they weren't sure if they were to use him or not, but they figured, you know, he's the person for the job. Whenever they had shots done from a distance, it was Bill instead of Harold. And then they switched back. Most of the comedians from those days wore heavy clown white makeup, big mustache, and they were just gaudy in general. Harold stood out for just being more natural and someone everyone can identify with, an everyman. The outdoor shots were the big things to watch in this because you get to see Los Angeles as it was in the 20s. I guess they did the climbing situation. I forgot how long it took. I don't know if they said 2 weeks or 2 months, but however long it took, everything you saw him do before that, they shot after that. So they got the action out of the way first. They tried to do as much as they could without title cards, which is what a lot of directors say because they want to show you through action instead of bogging you down with words. Although some movies I've watched, there's too much reading. And I think that's about it for me. It was just highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Lily, did you catch up already?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to basically do the synopsis of the film, but you kind of already did that. But, you know, Lloyd is a country boy, sets out from his hometown of Great Bend to make good in the big city. And, you know, basically same thing, Mildred Davis, his real life wife, you know, he promises to marry her once he's successful, but he keeps kind of finagling the truth, saying, you know, he's a GM of a department store when he's really just, you know, one of the sales clerks. And eventually she does come to the city to see how everything's going on. And then hilarity ensues, of course. But so he wants, yeah, basically. And the one way he needs money because he's broke. So basically how he plans or plots to get the money is he overhears his real general manager talking about, you know, what's a great idea that'll help bring in people to their store. And he thinks of his friend, who is Bill Strother, who in the film is his roommate as well, who climbed up the side of a building to escape a cop. So he's like, oh, I'll split the deal with you 50-50 if you can climb all the way up the building, so it'll make good for the store, and then he'll get $1,000, and then he can make his girlfriend proud. Except that he ends up, quote-unquote, climbing up the building himself, as in the film.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very good. I mean, for having known how they did the gags, it's the way they cut and pasted the film itself together. It still felt very real. Yeah. And I did have, you know, I was worried at certain parts if he might fall or what would happen, because he gets attacked by pigeons at one time. And, you know, when I was growing up, like, I remember hearing the pigeons coo outside my window. So I'm already like, oh. So he's attacked by pigeons, he's attacked by police officers, he's attacked by a dog, all while he's trying to climb up 14 stories or so on this building.
And the mouse.
And the mouse. And a block of wood.
I forgot that part. Oh, yeah. I remember.
But what, reading the bio, in a sense, from the San Francisco Silent Film Festival's webpage about Safety Last. It was Harold Lloyd's fourth and most complex thrill comedy. And he came upon the idea for the film after witnessing the human fly climb up the side of a tall building, which was Bill Strother. So naturally, he, while he was watching him and freaking out down below, he went to the top of the building where he met Bill, and he's like, you know, he gave him his address, told him to come out and visit Hal Roach and himself, and then he got listed to be a stuntman and work under Harold Lloyd. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I think it's his most known one.
Definitely. One of the most known. But it's a fun film as well, because, you know, it. I liked the sneakiness in kind of like him being a little shady with his girlfriend. I know it's not the best, but you never know when or if he might get caught, you know, especially seeing he's the general manager of the department store and bringing his girlfriend in there. And, you know, pushing buttons by mistake, and then, you know, his coworkers come in and you don't know what's going to happen, if he's going to get caught then. He never does, which is surprising.
I think that was a real store that they shot in.
Real department store. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think they could only shoot at night. And sometimes you can see that when they aim the camera where you can see the outside and it's night.
Hmm.
But, yeah, it's seems a little drab for a department store, though.
Well, it reminded me, of course, there's Joanne Fabrics now. He's working in the fabrics department. Yeah. So.
Yeah. What about when he had everyone dive to the floor so this one woman could get what she wanted? Because she was stronger than everyone. Yeah.
Dropping $50. Someone dropped $50 and everyone's like, oh!
Boom!
So like, here you go.
That was really good. A lot of good gags.
Probably
what
one about
of my favorites.
The beginning? Yeah.
What about the beginning when he's saying goodbye to everyone and it looks like he's in jail and there's a noose behind him?
Mm, and then it ends up being a train station. I was like, okay, right. That's clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually was, a couple decades ago when I was watching a lot of silent films, I don't think it was even available, the Harold Lloyd collection. So reading a little bit about this now, it wouldn't have been available. Whoever owns the rights to all of the filmographies, basically they didn't negotiate anything until, what was it, 2005? Onwards. It's actually from 2005 and beyond is when things started to loosen up and that you could have more access to watch his, filmography.
Yeah, it said it didn't reach the public domain until last year in 2019.
Well, this particular movie, but just his filmography in general, most of which, and then Criterion then a few years later licensed stuff, and that's why they're now releasing things like Safety Last, which is now on Blu-ray.
Well, the version I saw, it said 2005, so that matches up. And that's when the commentary was done.
Right, that's when they allowed people to start. So mine was earlier 2000, prior to that. So,
So
thinking back, really, I don't think I've ever seen Harold Lloyd just because, you know, that's when I was most active and hadn't really done it since, you know, until I launched this podcast. So this might be very much either the first or a handful. Maybe I watched his short. No, I don't remember. So this could be the first because for a long time, his work has not been available, you know?
Well, that explains why I got interested now instead of before.
It's really only now that things are loosening up and being available.
It's a good time to have access.
But I will say that if you watch a lot of the silent film comedies, it is maybe just my own personal opinion, you'll often get a few gags in between. Because the gags from back then might have been funny if you were living in, you know, the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. And I think you will have understood what they were going for when you watch the gag. Mm-hmm. But I think now we're so far removed. We're close, you know, very much 100 plus years. And I think a lot of those contexts of what initially made them funny is very much lost. I think a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them. So to have those comedy still work today as fresh as it was back then, for most of the film, it's going to be near impossible. I think a big chunk of the film, it still very much works. And so that's the feeling I have for the Chaplins and the Keatons. And except for maybe like City Lights. I think Chaplin took so long at making that movie that he perfected it. I think it did something or another. But with the exception of that one, I think, so having never seen Lloyd, I was very much astonished that I think he made like the perfect silent film comedy movie, like the perfect one.
Right.
Where you would go from one gag to the other that doesn't, in my opinion, rely on something that's
contemporary
of the context of its time, but rather that it's situational, that will last basically forever. And man, I was howling with laughter throughout the whole thing from start to finish. And I just haven't really experienced that. Even though we've seen so many silent film comedies here, but both on this podcast and my own, viewings. And so I was pleasantly surprised. And I think all of those people that really champions, that you've got fans who are in all these camps, right? Who are, some people like Jake Chaplin for the more sentimental. Some people like the Keaton for the stunt and realism. And then you've got people in this camp, the Lloyds. I don't think you have to be in all of them. I think you can take all of them and appreciate all of them, which is probably more what I like. But having not really seen his stuff from start to finish, I was really, like my jaws dropped to the floor. It's just an astonishing piece of work. That it's something that you can just drop in the middle of, even now in 2020, and still get a lot of out of it. It's still funny. It's still relevant. Like even in the beginning, you don't need any context to say that, oh, okay, well, he might be hanging. And all of a sudden, and his dad was almost like the chaplain, right? Reading his last rites and, his love, of course, but, with the mom, and you just don't know what the context, and the conductor was like the guard, jail guard or something, trying to hurry him to this. And of course you pull back, the Great Ben. And of course the Great Ben has multiple meanings of life, right? Not just the town of. And so it's like the scenarios or the stories are really rich and have multiple layers above and beyond just comedy, right? Like some of the greatest comedians are also some of the most deadly serious too, in terms of dramatics. There's always needs to be some sort of maybe not always, but there is commonly a tie-in, between something that's very dramatic and dark and the comedic,
Yeah.
So anyway, as I really, really enjoyed this movie, and it really, to me, feels like a perfect silent film comedy. Like from one gag to the other, there's just no letting up. I showed this, a few minutes, just the train station sequence to my wife for a few minutes, and she was like, wow, this is, she's never
really
watched movies in general. Actually, not just the modern movies, just movies in general. And
right.
She was like, this is pretty funny. And I never heard of her saying that. So I feel like it's something that you can take out of context, out of any time, and still work. It just works, as a film itself.
Yeah.
It doesn't really need to rely on anything. And Harold Lloyd himself plays this character to just perfection. Like the whole down and out character, a little bit effeminate, a little bit like loser like feeling that you get when you watch these type of down on their luck characters, and it definitely very much an underdog, right? And you feel him when he's trying to say, I'm gonna make something of myself before I send for you, some respect, respectability.
Right.
And of course, the minute reality hits, it's like he and his, I guess, is it Billy, the pal?
Bill Strother.
They were roommates, right? So the roommates, right. they can barely pay rent. And of course, the gag where the landlord knocks on the door, they when she tries to come in and check to see if they're home, they had to hide from her, and they hid from her by climbing into their coats hung on the wall.
Yeah.
Almost like sacks of, you know.
You couldn't say that, yeah.
Sacks of potatoes.
Yeah, potatoes. Or, you know, if you read into it a little bit more, like they're regressing into babies, you know, being stuffed back into the uterus. So I don't know. I just found I just found that every bits and pieces of this is just incredibly funny. Of
yeah,
the various gags, the timing is incredible. Mm-hmm. Everything is and you didn't need again to have some of those things. Like apartments still exist today. If you don't pay rent, you're still going to be out, down and out, and that's still relevant then, and it is relevant today. There's nothing unique to that time. I think. In terms of the human experience, that is different even now, and so yeah.
I've mentioned before on Sundays on YouTube they have Bill Modell, he does the silent comedies, and the thing I like about that is between him and Steve Masser, they talk about the comedy you're about to see and they explain the context. Like there was a cigar Indian outside the cigar store, and he goes, well, you probably don't even know what that is. And he explains what the context is. So that's the fun thing about that show.
Yeah, that's Sidetrack. That's highly recommended if you guys ever have a chance. And what's great is so far they've left them on YouTube, so you can always go back to the old stuff. Mm-hmm. Just Google or go on YouTube and search for Ben Modell, M-O-D-E-L, and look up his
silent comedies, yeah. He plays right live to the you know, like on the spur. I mean, he knows what the comedies are, but he hasn't written this ahead of time. He just plays, and he knows how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's as you would an accompanist these earlier days. So
I think it's just a really good show. Something for the whole family.
Yeah, highly recommended. But anyway, so going back to this Safety Last, I just found all of that incredible, you know, from start to finish. I can't find, to me personally, any fault of it. Maybe you haven't seen it enough. Afterwards, I think it started to play, is it the freshman? Or no, Speedy or something. That's the Keaton one. So and I just like, I want so much of it, and I stayed up a little bit to watch that, you know, even though I was watching it real late already. But it was so good. I loved it, you know, and, so anyways, Harold Lloyd, I highly recommend it, both this work or any of his works, I think. So.
Yeah. To me, those comedies are the predecessor to the cartoons I grew up with, the Bugs Bunny and so forth.
Right.
It's almost the same thing.
Yeah, which, you know, references a lot of this, especially the earlier ones.
So. Oh, yeah.
I was going to say probably one reason, too, that it's so enjoyable is it has a kind of naturalness to it. You know, nothing feels forced, especially in this film. I mean, the scenarios are a little wild at times, but I mean, hey, Black Friday is just as wild as it was in the store with all the women going after the fabric. So,
yeah. Hey, you know, there's a 50 on the floor. That would still work.
Mm-hmm. So, that was.
Oh, that reminds me of that scene where the lady only wanted a sample. So it was like 1 o'clock and he's about to leave for work. Yeah. His buddy's waiting for him.
I was so mad at her.
I know. And she came in and she's, you know, she's that retail store person, the last person.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Like right before it closes, right? And you know, I worked retail a long time ago in the past and I remember this, you know, it's like.
That still happens. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's closing time, you know, and this person walks in, it's like, make some.
And they want everything. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and they ruffle through everything. And all of a sudden, she just wanted a sample. She walks away and she's about to turn back. He just like climbs out of there.
She hides. It's like, see, natural. Cause it's like, it's still like that 100 years later. It's the same exact thing at like my job for the donut shop. You know, people are like, oh, what do you recommend? So we tell them this, that, the other, red, yellow, green, blue. Yeah. And then they're just like, you know what? I'm going to take a small salad. And they're just like, okay, we don't sell that, but whatever. You know what I mean? They're just like, oh, forget your opinion.
Yeah. They like to do a lot of bald and toupee jokes in those comedies too.
Yeah.
They did both in that movie. He was combing his hair on the reflection of the bald guy's head.
That's funny.
It's good visual effects too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think, like, you know, there are a lot of focus, of course, on the last scene, the climbing and stuff. Which, you know, I heard upon how it's influential even on stuff like Back to the Future when Doc is hanging off the clock, right? It's the obvious homage.
Oh, okay.
So,
together.
Yeah. It's, you know, throughout many, many movies, there's a lot of references like that. Anyway, so what was I trying to say was like, just that last scene, I think it is good, but I also feel like of all the comedies I've seen, there's a tendency, I'm not saying all of them are like that, but there's a tendency for silent film comedies to have a series of gags that connect to each other, which all of which harkens back to their silent short days, right? I think, Adam, you made this point about the Battle of the Century, even the Laura Hardy one. It was like three separate movies, basically, right? Just stitched together, you know?
Yeah.
Because there really is no through line, right? From the start.
Not that I saw. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, but what's different about this film is that there is a through line that even though that there are different gags throughout the entire movie itself, it's still about this idea that Harold Lloyd's playing this character that really wants to provide for his future family and make right, you know, both for himself, for the parents, for his future wife, right? I mean, he forgoes, even there's a scene in there, he forgoes a meal. Love that scene. Yes. Where he's like, he goes in to look for like a necklace or something that costs
for the
$16 or whatever it is.
15,
and as the last few coins that he has to give away, he gives like, you know, a certain amount of coins away. It means one less sandwich, you know. There's a visual representation of the meal that he was about to eat. And it was like, you know, one less, you know, egg, one less potato, whatever it was. You know, I don't remember the detail. But like, it was just like that.
Right.
Each plate disappearing. And finally, last coin, it was completely gone. And even though he has this thing, this necklace for his fiancée, / future wife, he literally tightened up his buckle.
Yeah.
So his belt, rather, and say, chin up, guy, let's keep going, you know, and this, I think that story, that through line is, I think what makes it, for me on the Lloyd films is that, at least for this one, that there's a through line. It's so strong, right? Every single piece and element of this feature is contributing towards that primary narrative. So it's not just going from one gag to another, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Probably Chaplin probably has the closer, I think, would be of the two. And I think a lot of the Keaton work is just from one gag to the other, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why I really enjoy it.
Yeah, very good film.
Mm-hmm.
Any other parting thoughts from y'all?
I think that's it for me.
I did found it interesting that they had a shot at the, speaking of the final shot of the building where he's climbing the building, there's a shot of it looking down. Like, the shots of Harold Lloyd climbing the building, we know how the effects are achieved. Do you want to take a stab at explaining it, either of you? Of how it works.
Well, the bottom half. Oh, go ahead, Lily.
Well, you talk about the bottom half. I'll talk about the actual top half.
The bottom half was the facade. I think it might have been. I'm not sure if it had to. Maybe it was in the studio. I didn't really understand that. But it wasn't a real building because it was made specifically for him to grab on. You know, if you put your hand in the crevice, there was a loop underneath so it could easily climb up. But from then after that, it was a building.
Okay, very interesting. Because the part that I remember watching in the old film stars talking about the films, so how they achieved the height was he was actually on it, like the roof of a building with the team, and then they had a giant platform to give more height and depth to make it seem as if he was climbing extremely high, where really he was only like 15 feet above the roof. But you know, he's still in safe distance of falling in case he did fall. He's not going to fall to the ground, you know, 10 stories. He's only going to fall 10 feet.
Yeah. It's amazing insurance covered that.
Yeah. Because they said
even 15 feet is still, you can hurt yourself.
Yeah, because they didn't even want him to do half the stunts because of the insurance. You know, you lose your star, forget it.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
And considering you only have one hand.
If you look at your message platform, I just sent you a link. And if you open it, it directs you to an article talking about that with screenshots. But then there's a video embedded in there. I think it's from Criterion, actually. Criterion Collection. It's one of the behind-the-scenes clips.
Oh.
Which has a CG model of how he did the effects, which is like,
basically
they selected a building, another high-rise building. They're just on the rooftops, and on top of the rooftop, they build a scaffold.
Mm-hmm.
And the scaffold will be a false wall. And so what Lloyd's climbing is a false wall on top of the scaffold, on top of a roof of a high-rise. And that high-rise, of course, the backdrop of the high-rise is the cityscape. And so visually, the camera is placed on a platform filming Lloyd climbing this fake false wall on a scaffold with the cityscape in the background. Of course, the camera itself is pretty so high up that you don't see the fact that you're on a roof of already a high rise yourself, right? That's the visual effect.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
What I'm saying? Or verbally trying to communicate it? It's always tough to verbally communicate effects sounds. But anyway,
I understand things best with sock puppets.
Yeah, so all three of us, knowing that effect and how it was done, still found it like riveting. I think part of the riveting part for me was that they had a shot looking downward from the roof. And I think of Billy, the limp guy, climbing the actual real building. So to me, I think that sells it. I think the false wall thing is because we already know how that works.
Right.
I think you can kind of, okay, I know how it works. But it's still like visually the way they shot it. I think it's those shots that looks down on the actual height of the building where you see the actual crowd at the bottom and Billy climbing an actual wall without any ropes.
Right.
I think that to me sells it because it's when you intercut that with Lloyd on the false wall, that to me, like if you didn't know any of this background like we do,
yeah,
you're going to be like, holy cow, he's actually on the wall.
Well, the commentary said that Bill was held with piano wire just as an added measure.
I see.
Yeah, and he didn't like that at all because he wanted to do it for real, but they said no.
Because that's how he did it, though. He did it for real,
right.
And that's how Lloyd
climbed.
So.
But they put piano wire on him. According to the commentary, I can only go by that.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Any other parting thoughts?
I'm good.
No, I was just reading about his safety last with the stunts, so... No, I don't have any more to add to this movie.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes, that link in there. But it really is timeless, this one. This one is not tied to any specific time. It's just, you know, it's comedy gold wrapped it's a pretty straightforward plot. It's not like, you know, unique or new or anything like that, but it's what he does with it, you know. And that's the best movies, is the plot's going to be there. It's not going to be anything different or weird or anything like that, but it's so very much how he makes the plot his own and how he actually goes about doing these things that makes the movie, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
And I think, you know, if we had all the time in the world, we'd keep talking about it, but we'll just wrap it up with that last thought. So Thank you very much, Lily. Thanks very much, Adam, and our listeners as well. And you can find more of our stuff at watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. Again, that's watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. And you can send us an email if you have questions, thoughts, comments at watchingsilentfilms@gmail.com. If you wouldn't mind still leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or any podcast platform you are reaching us by. And that's pretty much what we have. So thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Ciao. Bye.